sits in white satin, never reaching the end. Letters I've written, never meaning to send. Beauty I'd always miss with these eyes before. Just what the truth is, I can't say anymore, 'cause I love you.
Yeah, I'm fine. I do apologize for being late.
That's okay. We were talking with Justin Hayward, of course, well known with the Moody Blues as one of their one of the greatest songwriters we've had in the rock and roll era, and he has joined us here at PMP Network. I'm a huge Moody Blues fan, and it's kind of nice that the label is re-releasing all your stuff. Tell us, you must be a little excited about that.
Yeah, I'm very pleased that it's happened in the U.S. and because it was originally, I think Universal did it just for the UK and Europe, and I did these remasters a couple of years ago, and they were done when I went back and listened to the original digital master that was the transfer that was done in the 80s. I'd never really listened to it before, but I realized that there was a very bad fault on that when it was the transfer was first done. You can hear it on our Lost Chord album quite clearly, and I always thought it was just something that was on the original record because I got so used to hearing the CD version. But then when I went back to the vinyl master that was done in the 60s, and I listened to that, I realized how good it was, and so Universal were going to do this collection. And then I put my hand up and said, I really want to be part of the mastering. And they agreed to that. They very kindly agreed to that. So I'm really, really glad that it's come, because it'll be the definitive version, the one that's coming out now.
I have not received any of these from the record company, so I haven't looked at them. But are they the same packaging, or have they done things differently with them?
No, they've used the same sleeve. They're, for the first time as well, they've gone back to the original film of the sleeve. So they've used the original sleeves in their entirety. But they've also, there's a book with each one, with a lot of detail in it and facts and figures. Not written this time by any other band, not particularly interview stuff. And that was another thing I think was wrong with the 80s and 90s version of the CD. You know, there was, as people left the Moody Blues, they were kind of excluded from these kind of interviews, and that was wrong, really. So they did go back to the original stuff, and then they included quite a lot of unreleased things that were done at the same time as each album, which is quite interesting, too.
Well, that's always, I always find that the most fascinating, when they have stuff that hasn't been released before that you hear for the first time.
Well, I didn't think, when they told me that they were going to do that, they were going to look for this stuff, I quite sneakily thought, they'll never find anything, because I thought we'd hidden all that stuff away or destroyed it personally, because Tony Clark, our original producer, never used to like to keep anything that wasn't going to be released. And I thought there was nothing. There was a few rough mixes that I had personally that I'd taken home of songs that kind of didn't work at the time and were never released. But I was amazed at what they'd found. There was a couple of young guys at Universal in London who put their hearts in this, and they got totally immersed in the Moody Blues and what we were about. And they looked back at all the original outtakes and things like that, and they found some really interesting stuff, different versions of songs. And it's quite enlightening. And some of it was quite emotional, because it takes you back to the session. Took me back to sitting on my guitar chair doing these, actually recording these songs. It was quite enlightening.
You know, I think that most of us from the United States got our first taste of the Moody Blues with Go Now. And then it was years later when we heard them again. And that was when Tuesday Afternoon, Forever Afternoon, and Nights in White Satin became huge hits in America. And by that time, you had joined the band. Did you actually replace Denny Lane?
Yes, we sort of overlapped, but I came along when Denny was leaving, and John came along at the same time as me and replaced Clint Warwick, the original bass player. So there was the change of me and John arrived at the same time in the summer of 1966.
Wow.
And then, yes, it was up until then, it was a kind of cover band of doing R&B stuff. But that was, we were realizing that was getting us nowhere. And I was writing songs. I came to this band, actually, as a songwriter. It's the only reason I came to the band was because Mike Pinder in the Moody Blues had heard some of my songs, and he called me about them. And then he was writing songs, I was writing songs, but our songs didn't fit the kind of Moody's image. And then we invested in an instrument called the Mellotron that gave us a kind of orchestral kind of sound, and suddenly our songs worked. And then we were on a completely new road with a kind of green light, and it was wonderful. And a year later, within a year, we were brought to the U.S. by Bill Graham, which was fantastic.
Now, and you guys also did something that the Beatles did at one point. The Beatles spun off Apple Records under the auspices of Capitol, and you did the same thing with your record label Threshold after On the Threshold of a Dream.
Yes, exactly. And I think what we wanted, actually, was our purpose was to get control of our recordings and get control of what was released, and particularly the artwork. We wanted to do that ourselves, and we were very keen on having double sleeves with sort of books in them and that kind of stuff. And so we wanted control of that. And the label, once we'd done the sort of business, the end of it with Sir Edward Lewis at Decca, we didn't have much until that time, and then we still didn't have a great deal, but the Threshold label gave us that control over what was released and the visuals and all that kind of stuff. And it was a nice kind of dream for a while, but then things changed. Sir Edward Lewis died, and Decca moved on, and same as London Records moved on. But it was a wonderful company for us, and we owe them everything, really. Some of the people at Decca in London were really behind us, with from Days of Future Past right the way through to Seventh Sojourn. And we really owe them everything. I can't understate the contribution that they made.
It's interesting, if you think about Apple, a lot of people don't realize that Apple Records not only did the Beatles, but they signed people like Mary Hopkins and people like that. And in Threshold, you folks had like Providence and Trapeze signed as well. So it wasn't just the Moody Blues label. You guys were trying to make it go on its own, but the business of music and the music itself is two different things.
But you've got it exactly right, yes. And I think the business of music was what kind of finished it for us, because we thought that we'd have it like an artist's workshop where we had studio time and that kind of stuff, and people could come in and develop their ideas and songs, which they did. But what we didn't realize was that we'd have to be beaten up by people's managers as well, and that was the bit that none of us really fancied. And in the end, we realized that we just weren't any good at that, and the best thing we could do is just make our own music and travel our own road.
You talked about songwriting, and I know you were in bands before Moody Blues. Tell us a little bit about when you're writing a song. Some of the music, the best music that Moody Blues ever did was stuff you wrote. And what is it that inspires you? Is it something that you get a feeling and just write it down? How do you write? What does it comes first, the music, the lyrics, the thought?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for that. There's probably four other guys in the world that probably wouldn't agree with you, but I suppose really it's I can only do it from the heart, really. Sometimes I just I think of a phrase or something like that. But most of the time, it comes out of the guitar or out of a keyboard, and the guitar itself will suggest the melody of a song or the rhythm. And I've always been very conscious of rhythm in songs, really, ever since, you know, I heard Buddy Holly as a kid. I realized that was what it was about. And it's about the sort of rhythm and groove and the tempo of a thing. And after that, the guitar kind of suggests it, and then I don't really investigate it or try and look at it too closely, because I really like to let it happen. It's usually like, it's that old songwriter's cliche, it's 10% inspiration and 90% hard work, really. You have the germ of the idea, which, and you sift through all the ideas and find one that really moves you, and then you have to complete it. Then you spend weeks trying to complete it.
Mm.
It was very different when I was younger, and like during these first seven albums, because we were doing it against the clock. They just wanted another album, another album. The whole everybody in the music business was telling you, listen, you've got a year at the most. These groups, they come up, they're over. You know, so we were like racing against the clock to do things.
Hmm.
And it's a very different way of working. It's a much more leisurely thing now. And also what people want from us is different now. But the writing process is something that's very, very valuable to me. And I'm writing a lot just lately. And I'm very, very pleased with some of the things that I'm doing. They're quite different, but they're certainly from the heart. And it's the only way that I've ever found to express myself truthfully, I suppose.
Now, are you writing this for you, or are you doing stuff for the Moody Blues? What's the situation with it?
Now, that's the question, isn't it? I don't know the answer. It could be both. But I think I'm recording, and whether it turns into a Moody Blues record, then that would be nice too. But at the moment, I don't know. I'm just getting the stuff down. I'm just getting my guitar and the bones of it down and a good lead vocal. And then we'll see what happens from there.
What is the status of the band? Are you guys touring at all? Or when's the last time you went out?
We were out. We only just finished about a month ago. We were out for about 3 months already in the U.S. this year. And we did like a two-month tour. And then we came back to Hard Rock Park in Myrtle Beach to do that. And we put a couple of weeks' gigs around that. And we're just doing one-off things through the summer until we start in the UK in September. And then the rest of the year really is spent in the UK and in Europe through Scandinavia. And then we finish up in Germany. And I think we come back to the U.S. for a few gigs in December.
What has it been like in terms of the audience? Is it people my age? Are people in their 50s there? Or is it people of all ages going to see these shows?
Well, I noticed that there was a big change for us in the 80s when, to be quite honest, in the early 80s, even though we'd had a number one album with Long Distance Voyager, we weren't doing that great, and we weren't the promoter's favorite band all over the world. We weren't pulling the people anymore. And then suddenly we had a couple of songs, Your Wildest Dreams, and I Know You're Out There Somewhere, and that introduced a whole new audience to the band.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the bones of that's the basis of the kind of demographic that comes to see us nowadays. And it was born then, really, in the 80s. But fortunately, since we've been working with orchestras, which we started to do about 10 years ago, then a lot of people of my own age are coming back to see the band. And I notice in the UK particularly that it's mostly people of our own age. In America, it's a different kind of demographic. It's very much sort of 30s and 40-year-olds. In the UK, it's an older one, either the people of my age or very young people that are discovering it kind of for the first time.
Yeah.
It's interesting wherever you go. It's Australia, it's different again.
I'm glad you mentioned Your Wildest Dreams, because that was a song that again, brought you guys back to the forefront. And as a songwriter, how important is it that a song becomes a hit to you?
Well, you know, the life is just littered with failures all over the place, particularly with songs that I thought would do well and that would be hits. It was Wildest Dreams was one of the greatest experiences, if not the greatest I've ever been through. It was like a second go round at life, if you like. I was in my early 40s, and it was the same for all of us. We were in our early 40s, and here we were climbing up the charts with a hit single. And meeting a completely different kind of people. The promo guys were suddenly our best friends again. You know, I always loved you guys, that kind of stuff. We were everybody's favorite, and it happened all over the world, too. And it was a very precious thing, because I kind of missed it the first time around. I was so serious and ambitious through the 60s and 70s with what we were doing. And it was like I was in some kind of race back then, and where I had my head down, not looking. But in the 80s, I could really, we had a great manager and a man called Tom Hewlett, and we just couldn't do any wrong for about 3 or 4 years, and it was just such a wonderful thing. I could savor every moment. It was a wonderful time, really. I really treasure it. The best time for the band, and the band was playing great and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and the other thing about a songwriter, sometimes your songs are picked up by somebody else and they make a hit out of it. Has that happened with any of your compositions?
Well, it's happened with Nights a lot, and so that's, but you probably would expect it to happen with that.
Mm-hmm.
There's Tuesday Afternoon has been done quite a few different ways, and a rap version was sent to me a few months ago. That's pretty good, actually. It's not bad. It's just they've just sampled quite a bit of it. And then just recently, there's some guys that have done a fantastic dance mix, nothing to do with me or us or anything, of I Know You're Out There Somewhere, and just taking the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
And it really kind of turns me on. But there's a few other obscure things that people have done and that people have picked up on. And one of the most interesting things has been the a project called the Moody Bluegrass. It's just called Moody Bluegrass. And it's bluegrass artists down in Nashville that a tribute to the Moody's and taking all our songs and doing them in a bluegrass way.
Hmm.
And that was quite revealing, too. It made me look at the songs in a completely different light. It was very refreshing.
Yes, it kind of looks them in a raw way because they're different than that you wrote them at, which is kind of interesting.
Exactly, and they have a whole, bluegrass players have a whole set of rules. It's like no drums, no electric guitar, forget all of that kind of stuff. They come at it from a completely different direction. It's very enlightening.
Sounds it. The rock and roll business has gone so differently now, from records to CDs, now MP3s, and the Internet has been a huge change. How do you see the Internet in terms of the music business?
Well, for me, I suppose it's saved me a lot of time and trouble. It's opened a kind of door and a window to my own listening and musical experience, that's for sure. Whether I'm getting the best quality that I could, I don't know. I would still go out and buy the CD of something that I really wanted, because I'd feel much closer to the artist and to what they wanted to do, and I want to look at their sleeve and hear the way they mastered that record, and I don't want to have it as a download. But it's a window on another world, and now, of course, most of us can't ever conceive of being without it, because what would we do? God forbid. I think visually, sonically and visually, every way, it's changed the whole way I think of things. And it's allowed me, I suppose, to access music that I've always really loved but never been able to find. I went back, you know, and I've now collected a whole, all of my old Steely Seals and Crofts collection, who were really my favorites through the 70s. They were the best for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I could never find their stuff on CD. But it's only in the last year that the Internet has allowed me to do that and to listen to it and to make it available again. Interesting.
You know, the thing that's also interesting is when they re-release in different formats. I heard Days of Future Past in one of the Super Audio CD formats they released.
Mm-hmm.
That thing was amazing.
Well, there's a... When I was doing this remastering, of course, I looked at the... I don't know if I mentioned this before, but the 5.1 surround sound. And I'd forgotten that Tony Clark, the original producer, and Derek Varnors, neither of whom are working in that field anymore, had done these quad masters, and they were quite astounding, really. And I'm very glad that they were done at the time, particularly Days of Future Past, because it didn't take any remixing to put the 5.1 surround sound out, because it was done with the original echoes and all the original effects in the original studio, which was really precious.
I think it's really important that someone like yourself is doing the remastering, because you are so invested in the songs that you wrote.
Well, I put my hand up. You know, when it was happening, I was very lucky. There was a couple of young guys at Universal that were determined to do this project. And when I kind of saw it out of the corner of my eye happening, and I got in touch with them and said, listen, I really want to be part of this. And they were kind of, because it was a different generation. You know, these are very young guys looking at me, thinking, what does he know? You know, but... But anyway, I stuck at it, and I did it, and I went back to the original vinyl, and I did it in Italy with the mastering with one of my the guys that I work with at the studio there, and we found an Italian fan who was an Italian super fan who had all of the vinyl albums. He had a copy that he played, then he had a copy that was still in the original cellophane wrapper, untouched, and. Poor man, we persuaded him, or Alberto, my Italian engineer, did all the hard work, did all the chat, you know, on him. But we persuaded him to let us play his Virgin albums, the first seven albums. And of course, when we did hear them for the first time, unplayed albums, it was a real revelation to us. And it was a real way pointer forward, and I'm very, very grateful to him because he was a great gift.
Now, John Lodge said last year on a radio show that the new Moody Blues album is not far away. Is that the truth?
Wouldn't it be nice? Well, the truth is I don't know. It seems what people want from us is DVDs, and it's only just beginning to dawn on us because we have every year or so we get an offer to do a DVD, and there's one come round again now in Europe, and so I think maybe we just have to rethink how the Moody's is presented, and maybe the way forward is some new recordings coinciding with a DVD of those recordings, and maybe that's the way to make it happen. We're just about to release the our full concert at the Isle of Wight in 1970, something else which I mixed in Italy just recently. And that's coming out on DVD. It's the Murray Lerner film of us, our whole show there.
Oh, that'll be great.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I only thought that they'd only... Because Knights was part of the movie of the Isle of Wight. I just assumed that they'd only film one song. But Murray called me about a year ago and said, you know, we've got all this footage. And I said, no, I didn't know. And then I got involved with that and was able to mix it. And I was pleasantly surprised. I'm really pleased. It's really good. Graham and Ray play really well, which I was thankful for.
Now, one of the things that I remember at one point during the Moody Blues music was you taking up sitar.
Yeah.
Were you friends with George Harrison, or was it just purely a coincidence?
I was an acquaintance of George's. Friends would be going, putting a bit too far.
Yeah.
First of all, we got interested in transcendental meditation, the same as a lot of people did at that time. And we went to the Maharishi's place in London. The TM people had a big house in Eaton Square. I was probably the Beatles' money that funded it. But anyway, we were given the instruction there and initiated into that same group. And I think it was because through that, and Mike and I would just happen to find ourselves in the West End one day, and he said, you know, there's a little shop that sells all this Indian stuff that around the corner. And it wasn't George that had mentioned, I think it was John. John Lennon that had mentioned it to him, and to Mike, that is. And so we went in, and he bought a tambour, which is the thing that makes the drone instrument, that drone sound, and then I bought the sitar, and I got totally into it, and Ray was always trying to persuade, get the sitar out, get the sitar out. I said, no, you can't, you can only do it a couple of times, you can't keep doing it, you know. But I loved it, and I've still got it in my attic, and I can still tune it up. It's still got all its strings, and I would love to use it again. Of course, it's one of those things that's been sampled now, and you can just buy some download and go, and there it is. On
everything is like that nowadays. We got about two more minutes left, and there's a couple things I want to hit here.
Yeah.
What did you think about the... one of the things I thought was really interesting about some of the Moody Blues tunes was the poetry that Mike recited. Most of it was written by Graham Edge.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that, how that ended up with the songs.
It was a way of pulling the albums together, really. I suppose Graham would listen to the songs, and it was a way of expressing the album as a whole and giving it a kind of meaning. And I thought it was kind of risky at the time, but looking back, I think it was one of the greatest things we did. And Mike's voice was so perfect for that, beautiful speaking voice. He recorded most of it lying on his back in the studio in the dark with, holding a funny cigarette with a microphone over him.
Well, it does, you look at it now and you listen to it, and it really does fit in well with the whole concept.
I think so. It summed up the concept of each album, I think. That's what the purpose of it, and it did that very well. And Graham's a great writer of the spoken word.
And one other thing I wanted to ask you about was the guitar. You had talked before about how the guitar talked to you when you were writing. And you actually did things with the guitar that were pretty new in terms of the buzzing and the fuzz boxes and the pedals and stuff like that and the effects. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I'd always been in love with the Gibson 335, and as soon as I found the combination with that and a Vox amp, that I saw a guy called Joe Brown in the UK, and I knew him in my job before the Moody's. I used to be a guitar player for a rock and roll singer called Marty Wilde, and Joe was a big friend of Marty's, and I just adored Joe and his playing, and he had this wonderful 335. And then I realized that if you put it through the normal channel, not the bright channel, and really turn the thing up really loud, like Keith, I said, the first person I saw it doing, it was Keith Richard, was turning the thing full up on stage. And then I found that it just gave this lovely kind of sweet singing sound. And then one day I stumbled across this prototype thing that Marshall had made. I never saw another one that was a kind of mains fuzzbox thing. It gave such a sweet sound, and the engineer at Decca really kind of loved it, and it became a kind of signature sound. Whenever I've taken it back into the studio since, the engineers always say, "Oh no, it's too dirty. It's so noisy. I can't use that." You know, people's ears have changed now, and dirty isn't good anymore. But I think I might revisit it because I like the sitar. It's sitting up there in the attic with the sitar, and I might resurrect it again.
It sounds like you got a lot of tales to tell in the future, and I hope we can talk again sometime because we run out of time.
I look forward to that.
Justin, it's a real pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.